Hi, this is Senator Bernie Sanders. Last year, along with John Nichols, the great progressive journalist with The Nation magazine, I wrote a best-selling book called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. In it, we tackle the issues that you don't hear much about in the mainstream media, from the extraordinary wealth and income inequality that our nation is experiencing, to the growing labor movement, to corporate control over the media itself. If I must say so myself, this is a very good book, and it's just been republished in paperback. If you'd like a copy of the book, please make a donation of $12 or more, or whatever you can afford, to my campaign, and we will get you a copy. You can do this at BernieSanders.com/book. Again, that's BernieSanders.com/book. Thank you very much.
If there's an overarching theme in the book, it is oligarchy. It comes up a lot. And Senator, when you ran for president in 2016 and 2020, you pretty much introduced that term, that word oligarchy and plutocracy, to the American political process. This is not a word that politicians, at least nobody in modern times, had used. And it worked. Why do you think it worked?
Well, if it really worked, John, we'd be having this interview in the Oval Office.
It's not far from the Oval Office.
One of the things that I've learned over the years is that the more important the issue, the less it is discussed. The less important the issue, the more it often is discussed. So if you were going to ask me, in terms of American politics, American economics, what is the most important issue, I would say it is the growth of oligarchy in the United States of America. What does that mean? Well, this is what it means. It means that as a nation today, we have more income and wealth inequality than we've ever had in the history of this country. You hear that discussed on NBC very often? Maybe never.
Answer no.
All right, and then you have, you know, like three people who own more wealth than the bottom half of American society. So, you know, we talk about America being the nation of opportunity, the nation of democracy, everybody gets a fair shake, all of that nice rhetoric. Where is the outrage? Where is the outrage that a few blocks away from here, people are sleeping out on the street, schools are falling apart, moms can't afford to take care of their kids because we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth. Three people or more wealth, bottom half of American society. So you take a deep breath and you say, well, why aren't we discussing those issues? Well, it takes you to the political system. And this is certainly our issues never talked about, virtually never talked about, few exceptions, in the halls of Congress, not in the House, not in the Senate. Well, what does that have to do with our campaign finance system? Well, as you well know, we have increasingly billionaires, very wealthy people, determining who gets elected. Super PACs and PACs in general put huge amounts of money into people's campaigns. I think the average candidate wants to go up there and say, maybe the wealthiest people should start paying their fair share of taxes, et cetera, et cetera. So oligarchy is not only massive income and wealth inequality, it is extraordinary power over the political system, okay? And it's getting worse and worse. You know, I was thinking back, you know, democracy, modern democracy, forgetting the Greeks way back, is a fairly new phenomenon, probably starting, what, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the changes we saw in Europe, where the ideology was that ordinary people, working people, lower-income people, should have the right to vote, should have the right to elect representatives who will make important decisions for their lives. It's a beautiful thought. And now what we are seeing is not only an attack on people's right to vote, which in Republican states is happening, but you're saying, yeah, you got a right to vote, but I'm a billionaire, I'm going to put a couple $100 million into the campaign. That's it. You get one vote, and I get to spend several $100 million defeating your candidate. What do you think? How's that? Good democracy? And then, on top of that, you got an economy, you know, people say, the backbone of America is small business, right? Mm-hmm. No, it's not. What you're seeing in every sector of our society are fewer and fewer large multinational corporations controlling the sector. One example, maybe the most important. You have three Wall Street investment firms, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, that combined control, they don't own it, control over $20 trillion in assets. Three companies.
Let's pause there for a second, because most people can't put their head around $20 trillion. That's a lot of money.
Yes, I think, John, we can
establish that. In fact, that's actually
that's
where,
what investigative reporting
that's,
is
that's
all
what
about.
It's all
is
about.
Determined?
But yes. You chair the budget committee. You've chaired the budget committee.
And I will agree.
In the past.
$20 trillion is a lot of money.
But that is the economy.
Yes.
Effectively, it's not. In reality, it's not a bunch of money. It's the economy itself.
Right. And it is, if you combine the three, they are the major stockholders in 95% of the Standard & Poor's 500 corporations. So three boards of directors, I don't know, maybe 50 people, 100 people, I don't know what they are, and their CEOs have unbelievable power. Now, it's one thing to say, I am concerned, you are concerned about the power. How often do we even discuss that issue? It's not on the table to be discussed. And that takes us to another issue, which you know a lot about. You've written a few books on it. And that is what we are allowed to discuss or not. And that is media. Now, Donald Trump goes around and says, oh, fake news. Somebody wrote a story attack. Fake news. All the reporters are liars. That's nonsense. I deal with reporters every day. Very, very, very rarely am I misquoted. For example, the issue is not fake news. The issue is what media will talk about, is allowed to talk about culturally, and what they are not. I mean, I can give you a million examples, but one example. We are the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people as a human right. You would think that if I walked into, down the hallways of the Senate, where there are dozens and dozens and dozens of reporters, they're there every minute, every day, asking all kinds of questions. Somebody say, Bernie, how does it happen that in America, we're the only country that can guarantee health care to all people? Pretty simple question, right?
Yeah.
Never been asked. Bernie, what are you going to do about income and wealth inequality? Never asked. Bernie, what are you going to do about childhood poverty? Never asked. So those are issues that are kind of, that are outside of the worldview of mainstream media. We're not supposed to talk about that. And that gets back to what you know better than I do. Is you got what you have it, eight major media conglomerates?
It's not that
now?
Many anymore, it's less. Yeah, okay. It keeps reducing.
Their
yeah.
control about what about 90% of what the American people see, hear, and read. So, back home, you turn on your TV and you think you spend the fortune and you got 150 cable channels, right?
Yep.
And you think, oh my God, look at the diversity of views we have. But turns out that they're owned by three, four, whatever.
Same companies giving you both sides of their narrow point of view. But you're talking about media, and we're gonna do a whole segment in this discussion about media. But what we're also saying is that media is an underpinning of democracy because it's the information, right? And so it's not just media, it's our politics. Our politics doesn't have debates about the issues that actually matter. That's sort of the point of our book, is to say, it is okay to be angry about capitalism. It's bizarre that we have to say that, but in fact, nobody else is telling people
right.
that.
The reason that, with your help, I wrote the book is precisely to try to force debate on issues that almost nobody is willing to talk about. Mm-hmm. So, how do you, if you say to somebody, and I've said it a million times, you go to a town meeting and the 500 people in the audience say, how many of you think it's okay that three people own more wealth than the bottom half of American society? Nobody thinks it's okay. How many people think it's okay that billionaires are able to buy elections? Nobody thinks it's okay. How many people think that we're spending $900 billion on the military and yet we're cutting funding for hungry kids? Nobody thinks it's okay. But those are not the kinds of issues that are really seriously discussed in Congress.
And when those issues aren't discussed, right, that actually has another effect on politics. Because one of the most nefarious aspects of politics is that people are unhappy, they have frustrations, and they're being told, don't blame uber capitalism, don't blame the oligarchs, blame your neighbor, blame somebody down the street.
Look, what the function of politics in a democratic society should be about is, for a start, trying to determine what the real issues are. Okay? And then understanding what the cause of the problem is. Okay? And then understanding how do we fix it? And if you don't do that, and people are hurting. So if I'm out there and I'm making $25,000, $30,000 a year, and I can't afford health care, and my rent is going up, I am hurting. And I want an explanation for it. And if I don't get an explanation that talks about what wealth and power are doing to create your situation, the fact that the rich are getting phenomenally rich. So let me underline what we say in the book a dozen times, is that the current economic system is doing fantastically well. Never been better for the people on top. Never been better. But it is falling far beyond, far below what ordinary people need. But if people are not discussing the whys, then why am I hurting? Well, it must be the immigrants. It must be blacks. It must be gays taking over the schools. You know, then you fill the gap. You fill the void with all kinds of answers that simply are untrue. Always underlined by the fact that you never have the guts. Trump and his friends will never have the guts of taking on the big money interests. That's not what they do. So you'll blame. And this is, you know, it's not just Trump and what Republicans do today. This is demagoguery 101.
Yeah, goes back throughout the history of the country.
Yeah, you always, not only our country, the history of the world. Yeah. You take a minority that is reasonably politically powerless and you beat up on them. But you never focus your attention on the people who have the wealth and the power because they're too dangerous. You can't deal with them.
And that is our political circumstance today. By and large, even as hard as you have tried, and frankly, as a number of other people have tried, Jesse Jackson, people you've backed over the years, we still don't have those discussions at the level that we should. You know, it would be reasonable to say if you just kind of woke up one morning and said, "Wow, look at this level of income inequality in America," that'd be like, "Wow, we should kind of cancel the other debates in Congress today and go right to that."
You can.
But yet it's sort of like it keeps boiling along without.
Because if you talk about income and wealth inequality, you're going to be talking about the huge tax breaks that the wealthiest people get. You're going to talk about the kinds of monopolies that exist in the economy, which enables these guys to make huge sums of money. You're going to be talking about terrible trade agreements, which enrich, you know, the people who own these corporations. So it's best not talk about that at all. The simplest example that I can give, John, because it impacts everybody and it's right there in front of us, is we have a healthcare system, I wouldn't call it a system, but a healthcare entity that is broken and dysfunctional. Everybody knows that. Talk to any group you want. And we are now spending over $13,000, huge sum of money for every man, woman, and child, a family of four out there, total expenditures over $52,000. It's more than that, or maybe the equivalent of what that average family may make. Okay? It's unsustainable. It's outrageous. It is twice as much as what other countries around the world spent. So the question, not you don't have to be a great investigative journalist to ask a simple question. If we're spending twice as much per capita on healthcare as any other country, why is it that on virtually every social outcome, we are falling behind other countries in terms of life expectancy, in terms of infant mortality, maternal mortality rates, etc.? And why is it that we end up with having over 85 million Americans uninsured or underinsured? In other words, this is a system that is pathetic.
It's a system that's failing.
It's failing, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The only people who are benefiting are the insurance companies and the drug companies and some of the hospitals. How often do you hear that discussion? In fact, I live 50 miles away from Canada. Canada is not some kind of radical socialist nation. And it's more or less like the United States of America. But what was it, 30 or 40 years ago in Saskatchewan, who, Tommy Douglas?
It's a lot more than that, my friend. It's 80 years ago.
No.
80 years ago, the 1940s, that's when Tommy Douglas came to power in Saskatchewan.
Oh, well, he may have come to power, but they didn't pass that until the 60s.
It. No. He worked it up along the way.
Okay. Right? And then finally Saskatchewan.
Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What John and I are mumbling about here is that a province in Canada.
This is what I really care about.
A guy named Tommy Douglas, who nobody has ever heard of except people in Canada.
Yeah.
Was premier of Saskatchewan, yep. One of the provinces. And he finally brought about health care for all.
Yep.
And it was so popular, it spread all over the country. Bottom line is, getting to the point here, is that in Canada today, if you go into a hospital with a serious illness, you come out 3 weeks later, what is the bill that you pay?
It's a paperwork bill. It's like a couple bucks to make Zero. Sure the paperwork. It's, you know, it's nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah, it's nothing.
It's nothing. And yet they end up managing to spend half as much per capita as we do. Now you
And they're living long. They're starting
right,
to live.
Right. Yeah. Now, John, you might think that one or two people on Capitol Hill would say, that is interesting. We should pursue it. And I'm being facetious here. The answer is we do have 100-plus people in the House on Medicare for All.
Yep.
I don't know, we've got 15 or so in the Senate. But this is such a non-brainer. You have a failing system which spends twice as much per capita as any other country on earth. You have not heard one program on television talking about this.
Fine programming right here.
But there it is. On the-
But this is one of the things we try to do in the book is to introduce some new measures of how we look at our society and how it's doing. And one of those you mentioned just briefly, which is life expectancy.
Right.
And also the inequality of life expectancy from one zip code to another.
No. Not only do we not talk about healthcare, this is an issue we're never... Although I got to apologize here. Some months ago, the Washington Post actually did pay attention to it. Yeah. I got to give them credit. But it is very rare. You know, we start off by somewhere in the book, we write, you know, what is, at the end of the day, what is the goal of all this stuff? What is the goal of government and politics? It's to create a society where people are living long, happy, and productive lives. I mean, it seems kind of simplistic, but that's really what it's about, right? And in terms, you know, one of those things that you're striving for is longer life. So you got two realities. Number one, for many years now, the United States has lagged pretty far behind many other countries in how long we live, right? What, Japan is, what, 7-8 years?
When you go around the world, you're going to find that Japan is well ahead. The Scandinavian countries are moving well ahead. And those numbers can, now you are talking 4, 5, 6, 7.
And then the other reality you have is not only do we lag behind other countries in how long we live, the class gap is extraordinary.
Inside the U.S.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's something almost never talked about. So in the book, we talk about, I think there was a town in West Virginia, which is a pretty poor state. And it's a couple of hundred miles away from, was it Fairfax, Virginia, which is a wealthy community. And it's like, was it a 12, 13-year gap in life expectancy?
But even in D.C.
Even right now.
Here, like from zip codes in D.C., you'd find, you know, you're in one place, and sometimes it can be a 20, 30-year difference in how long you live. And that's about a class distinction, right?
So, bottom line here, despite spending $13,000 a year on healthcare, we lag far behind other countries in terms of life expectancies. And if you're in the working class or poor, you lag far behind the life expectancy of wealthy people. Is that an issue we talk about? Almost never. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And by the way, as we discuss in the book, it is not just our dysfunctional healthcare system which contributes to that tragic reality. It is the stress that working class people today are forced to live under. And if you've never lived in that situation, you maybe don't really feel it and appreciate it. But if you're a mom trying to bring up your kid, and the landlord says, I'm sorry, I'm raising your rent by 50%, you got to figure out where you're going to get another apartment, how you're going to get your kid into another school, you can deal with all that. If you're an older person, and a quarter of the senior citizens in this country are living on $15,000 a year, I don't know anyone lives on $15,000 a year, how do you pay for your prescription drugs? Maybe you're on Medicaid, maybe you're not. You've got to fill out 28 forms for all these things. Point is that just surviving for working class people is enormously stressful. And stress kills. That's the reality. It leads to all kinds of other diseases, not to mention mental health crises that we face. So we talk about it in the book, and we come up with some solutions, what we think are good solutions to this. But this is a reality that is largely ignored by the establishment.
So you grew up working class.
Yeah.
You literally grew up you know, worrying about paycheck to paycheck.
Yep. Every day. And, you know, I've often said this. I don't, you know, like talking about my family and myself all that much. But, you know, the dynamic of my family is a family of four. And my father, we were not poor. And my father worked every day of his life, worked hard, never made any money. And it was paycheck to paycheck. And the arguments, you know, it's something that has, I think, impacted my personality, or who I am, is the terrible arguments that my parents would have always over money. My father, you know, came to this country at the age of 17 from Poland without a nickel in his pocket. So he thought we were doing just great by living in a rent-controlled apartment in Brooklyn, New York. For him, that was a major step up from the very, very poor town that he grew up in, Poland. My mother was born in America and had American expectations. She wanted her own home. And that was a dream. And she died at the age of 46 and never got out of that rent-controlled apartment. But, you know, when you go shopping, I don't know if I write about it in the book or not, but I'll never forget, this is a true story. The fashion of the time with leather jackets, with little fur collars, I don't know. I think that, like, Air Force guys wear,
you know, aviator jacket.
Yeah, right. That was the fashion when I was a kid. So they're fairly expensive. So my mother and I walked downtown. We walked to where we shopped. It was called King's Highway. Went into a store there. And it's too expensive. We can't buy it. So we got on the train. We went to Manhattan, where the department stores. Honest to God, we must have gone to a dozen bloody department stores. That's why I hate to shop today. Went to a dozen different departments, trying to find the cheapest, you know, jacket. But that's, you know, what money is about. And again, we were not poor, but we were just, you know, money was prevalent and part of every argument that my parents were.
And that locked in with you. That at least it shaped some of your thinking at some place along the way.
Shaped all of my thinking all along the way. I mean, you know, it was my life, and it's the life that millions of people live today. But I experienced it. And again, people are a lot worse off than our family was.
You came to identify as a democratic socialist.
Yeah.
And one of the things we talk about this in the book quite a bit. What you argue is that democratic socialism, A, obviously, it's got roots in America. Eugene Victor Debs was here and others. But B, that it intersects with a lot of other politics. You can use different terms. FDR at his peak was doing a lot of things that were accused of being socialistic, but what it was really about was taming capitalism, right? It was trying to get some sort of control over capitalism so it didn't roll over people at a level that overwhelmed
them.
Well,
going back to Roosevelt, and we talk about this in the book, it's kind of broadening what democracy is supposed to be. Right, if you tell people, wow, man, in America, you have the right to vote every 2 years for your member of Congress, every 4 years for the president of the United States. What more in life do you want? That's called democracy. And, you know, we got 40% of the people don't vote. Well, I don't know what the number is, something like that. Local elections, much higher than that. Nobody votes. All right. So what Roosevelt expanded, and he said that, you know, democracy is not just political rights, as important as they are. We're very proud of our Constitution and all of the Bill of Rights and freedom of expression and freedom of assembly and freedom of religion, all of which is terribly important. And we support it 100%. But he said, you got to go deeper than that. That democracy also means that everybody is entitled, underline that word. You got our Republican friends very nervous about entitlements. Well, let's broaden the concept of entitlements. They don't like Social Security and Medicare. That ain't nothing. What we're talking about is much more. As a human being, you are entitled to a decent standard of living. What does that mean? It means, in the broader sense, a decent paying job. You don't go to work at starvation wages. You live in a decent house. You have, you know, decent diet. You have access to health care. Your kids have the right to the best educational system that the country can offer. Those are basic rights. Is that really so bloody radical? Is that utopian? I don't think so. I mean, in fact, one of the chapters that we have in the book, we talk to the Minister of Education in Finland.
Yeah.
And, you know, talk about their educational system. But all over the world, and every country does it differently. Well, guess what? People have a right to health care as citizens. people have a right to free education. People do have affordable housing. That exists right now in countries that have nowhere near the wealth that we have. So what we're talking about ain't all that radical, but it's something that we've got to put out there on the progressive agenda and organize and fight for.
And this is an interesting thing, because it's obviously this is for you a moral issue or an issue that you care about deeply, but there's also a practical politics element of this. We're just talking about Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt won the biggest victories for the Democratic Party, right? And his re-election in 1936 was a landslide that still is the epic.
As goes Maine, so goes Vermont.
That was the, there's a lot of explanation there, but the bottom line was those are the only two states that voted for Alf Landon against Roosevelt in 36. And by the way, that is a measure of what you accomplished in Vermont, because
we kind of transformed the state.
You helped with a lot of other people to transform that state. But here was one of the things, and maybe a lesson for Democrats. Roosevelt was willing to say in that 1936 campaign, when he won the epic majority, kind of American history, about bankers and speculators and Wall Street, I welcome their hatred. He was willing to make that distinction.
Look, I try as a politician to simply be honest with people. And if you're going to be honest, you got to tell it the way it is. And the way it is that the people on top are, by and large, with some exceptions, greedy bastards who are not content with a few billion they have. They want more and more. It really is. And we have seen that. I personally get involved in these things. Drug companies make huge amounts of money. People die because they can't afford a drug that costs a few bucks to manufacture. It doesn't matter. We need more and more money. And Roosevelt said, okay, I am fighting for you, the working class of this country. They hate me. And you know what? I must be doing something right. I must have earned their hatred. And if I've earned their hatred, I welcome their hatred. That's a good thing. We don't have too many politicians saying that right now. Very few. But we need that. We need to have politicians who make it clear, that old Woody Guthrie song, which side are you on? And you can't be begging billionaires for campaign contributions and standing up for the working class. You can't. And you got to make it clear which side you are on. And I think when we make it clear that the working class of this country, when they are well organized, when we are not subjected to racism or sexism or homophobia, when we all stand together, there is just unbelievable things, unimaginable things that we can accomplish.
We're going to give Florence Reese from down in Kentucky credit for writing Which Side Are You On? And Woody Guthrie.
She was a coal miner's wife.
Yeah. And Woody Guthrie credit for taking it out, and along with Pete Seeger and others. One of the most provocative things that the book says is that billionaires should not exist. That is that's drawn a bit of a line in the sand. But it also, I found this, and I know that when we went out and toured a little bit and talked to people around the country, I didn't find a lot of people that thought that was a bad idea.
Look, the idea that you have people who are worth, the Musks, the Bezos of the world, and Gates of the world, who are worth so much, I mean, $150, $200 billion, is insane. I mean, it's nothing. What does that number mean? What do you do with, what's the between 150 and 200 billion? What do you do? You buy more food? You buy more houses? What does it mean? It's just power. If you have $1 billion, you're gonna have enough money to leave your family for generations to come. You could do everything you want. You want to live very, in fancy ways, and do conspicuous consumption. You want to buy 10 homes? You can buy 10 homes. You can buy your own jet plane. But you don't need $100 billion. You don't need $50 billion. You don't need $10 billion. And not only is, I think, morally unacceptable, it is bad economics. And from a cultural point of view, it really bothers me. And we get that into a book. I want kids today in school to say, you know what? I want to be a great scientist, or I want to be a great teacher, or I want to be a great doctor, or I want to be a great construction worker, take pride in building roads or building houses or whatever it may be. I want to take pride in that. And to a large degree, what this greed, this glorification of greed is about, the kids say, I just got to make money, no matter how I make money. It's not what I do. So you have wonderful, wonderful teachers out there who are just doing extraordinary things, working for 30 years, impacting hundreds, if not thousands of kids. And they're not important. You know, some guy out there up there is making $100 million. Oh, my God. It's the end of the world. So I think this glorification of money and greed is very, very destructive to the whole fabric of our society.
And on that note, we're going to finish this segment, and we're going to invite people to keep watching and keep listening, because we're going to come back in our next segment and talk about the folks who are trying to take on some of that greed. We're going to talk about unions, and we're going to talk about the rising labor movement in this country.
If you'd like a copy of the book, please make a donation of $12 or more, or whatever you can afford, to my campaign, and we will get you a copy. You can do this at BernieSanders.com/book. Again, that's BernieSanders.com/book. Thank you very much.